Hey gang, Alex here. Today we interrupt your regular Super Beard Show programming for something we think you're really going to enjoy. First of all, Nostalgia Hunters, our Super Beard Bowl series all about Brett and I hunting down our favorite discontinued snacks as a way to reconnect with our childhoods, is coming back with more great episodes in the very near future. So, to celebrate, in addition to the normal podcast we put out each month, we're also going to be doing a special podcast series featuring much more extensive interviews with some of the experts we spoke with in creating the show. First up, it's Jason Liebig, who's basically the Indiana Jones of candy and snack packaging. He's the creator of CollectingCandy.com. He regularly provides scans and consults for TV and film productions set in various time periods, and he's on all kinds of TV shows about candy as one of the foremost experts in this extremely awesome and extremely interesting field. Jason had so many stories to tell. Our full, unedited call with him went on for almost 2 hours, and we've edited those conversations down into a couple very interesting chunks that we'll dive into over the next 45 minutes or so. Up first, when Jason finds out we're hoping to actually drink Ecto Cooler, he gives us some insight into the wonderful world of old expired food.
All right, so I gotta ask, are you going into the realm of stunt eating? Is that what we're talking about?
Bro, so listen, we didn't do this to stunt eat. Like, okay. Look, we don't stunt eat to live, but we don't live to stunt eat, but we might stunt eat to live.
Like, I've seen the trend growing. I mean, I'm sort of like, I'd like to believe I'm one of the foundational voices in the modern geek culture understanding of this stuff.
Okay.
And I've seen the success of stunt eating. You know, my friend Matt over at Dinosaur Dracula has like shown an old can of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pasta or whatever, and it gets like, I don't know, like 100,000 Twitter or retweets or whatever. So I see the appeal and the entertainment value of it all. To get back to your question, specifically with Ecto Cooler, there was actually a guy, Adam Richman, did this show called Adam Eats the 80s on History Channel, to hold the story. But he did go to a guy, a big Ghostbusters collector who had a full Ecto Cooler box, drink box, and they punched into that and they drank it like idiots.
Was it like original Ecto Cooler?
Original Ecto Cooler, like 1990 Ecto Cooler.
Well, how beautiful was his funeral after he drank it?
They said it still tasted citrusy. I mean, it is essentially water with some, with some ingredients and sugar. Provided there wasn't real fruit juice in there, and there may have been, I can't remember the ingredients. I do have a couple of empty Ecto Cooler boxes from that period, but if there's no real fruit juice, and even if they say there's real fruit juice, might be like, it's nothing enough to really truly go rancid. Because that's what you don't want. Like, I've opened packs of what are essentially 60-year-old Starbursts, and there's enough real fruit in there or ingredients to go what I would call a version of candy rancid. It's pretty terrible.
I see. Yeah.
But so, like, unopened food is really tough. By design, it doesn't survive. I always like to describe, because when people tell me, do you have like archives of old food? And I said, no, man, one of the first things I try to do when I get something, even if I get something that's very old and still has food in it, is divorce the food from the packaging, because I'm trying to archive and preserve the stuff. There's a great line in the original Lost Boys movie where they talk about how vampires go out. Some explode, some implode, some do this, some dissolve. No, one thing they're going to try to do is they're always going to try to take you out with them. And I always say that's sort of like, that's what vintage food is like.
this show is becoming one of my favorite things. Anything that can lead us into a segue into the fucking Lost Boys, we're doing something right.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
So apparently there's some out there, but I mean, the good thing is there seems to be a fair amount of Ecto Cooler. And I've seen like the plastic bottles survive. Yeah.
That's one of the ones that's on eBay. Yeah.
If you Google image, there's, I think, one, and you can see how it's all twisted and the colors change to this really horrible, horrible, shade. Old liquids, man. It's, but, even as a person who's been in this, like, people who want to save old stuff like that, I will always advise them, look, if you want to get into this, I would never recommend saving things. Even my brother had some of the cool Mountain Dew from like 15 years ago, the Game Fuel with Halo on it or whatever. Had a couple cases underneath a pinball machine that he had, right? Huh. This stuff was probably 7 years old, not old. Climate controlled, always like 70 degrees, right? All of a sudden, one day he walks in and there's all this stuff just on his floor, like the leaked or burst or whatever. And so even if, like, I would have never guessed that an aluminum can would just burst in that amount of time, unless you had, I don't know, in like an attic or a garage or something. But no, so I've learned some lessons the hard way about old food. But Ecto Cooler, like I said, I just saw it on a television program on a network that I work with, and it's a real thing. They drank it. They showed what it looked like. It was objectively disgusting.
So from a preservation angle, since you're kind of like the guy, I would say, like, literally every single person that we talked to was like, you got to talk to Jason.
Thank you.
like with, let's say a new Ecto Cooler emerges from, you know, just people who somebody happened to have some.
Yes.
Do you want to see the Ecto Cooler remain in the box, or do you want to see it like how you do it, where you kind of divorce the two?
I mean, look, for me, the answer's simple. Like, for me, that I have no concern of what's in the box, truly, right? I mean, what it was, when the thing that we are nostalgic for, that doesn't exist in that box anymore. It's become this other thing.
Right.
And the part of it that you can still see that still evokes some of those memories, the visual memories and everything else, that if you want that to survive, you got to get that stuff out of it. There are cereal box collectors who stand by collecting full boxes of cereal. And you know what? You can look, I've seen it. People have boxes 50 years. They're fine. You know, critters haven't gotten into there, but sometimes those little boar worms or whatever they are, they get into food. You know, people get them in their pantries. They can get into old stuff as well.
Watch out for that.
Sometimes some cereals, depending on what they're made of and the temperatures and the humidity, sometimes it's down to the humidity in the factory, the day they were made or the week they were made. So there's a lot of stuff. I always say I'm on the cutting edge of the science of like old processed food. Like, no one's ever studied what happens to processed food after 10 years, but I sort of inadvertently have. But sometimes cereal can expand weirdly, and so it can start to bend and destroy the box. But sometimes it works. I have a big archive of soft chunk bubblegum. Soft chunk bubblegum is the technical or the industry term for the bubblegum. Bubblicious, Hubba Bubba.
I kind of get what you're saying.
The squares.
Yeah, they called it soft chunk because it was the first bubble gum that was soft as soon as you open the pack, right? Before that, it was something it was like hard as rock, you have to chew and work.
Right.
That stuff is a lot of sugar and it's juicy. And so you will find old packs that people save because they love the way they look, but I'll open them up and it looks like colored syrup is inside there. And a lot of times you'll see that syrup has saturated the paper of the wrapper.
Oh.
And so the wrapper has just like got this 50-year-old sugar syrup that has destroyed it. Novelty bubblegum was big in the 80s and 90s, especially in the 90s, you know, the bubble beepers, the bubble CD players, all this other stuff. And so people say that's probably outside of Pez, in the category of candy, that's probably the most saved stuff you'll find. Most other stuff is ephemeral and you can't find it, but that stuff. So people have totes of it, but then they'll open up the totes after years and their bubble tape will have syruped out over to other things. And so they'll just open it up and there's all the stuff stuck together. And they're like, that's not the way it looked when I opened it. So I do work when I get things like that. I'll get those old packs and I'll open them up. I'll try to clean up the syrup that's inside there, get it to where it's dry, where there's no signs of that. And, you know, some people are like, oh, how could you do that? But now that they're stable, once they're stable, they're stable. You know,
I see.
I get to throw them in a bag and board.
I hear what you're saying. You're trying to save. You're doing triage on these streets.
Yes, I am a historian. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm a degenerate collector, but I'm more historian than collector.
I see. Okay.
For me. But so that my thing is, I want to see the packaging preserved. To answer your question in a roundabout way, I think the contents are fascinating. They're certainly interesting. Like when Matt opened that old pasta, look, I'm with you. I'm curious. It's interesting. On my website 10 years ago, I did a thing where I had Mars and Hershey bars from 1981 and I opened them and I showed comparisons of size and everything else. So like, and I cut them open just to show you what they would look like, which I think is interesting from a sort of how things have changed. Sam.
Right.
I also found it fascinating that the UPC codes on those like 1981 unopened packs were the same as the current ones. So if they somehow found their way into like a Walgreens, they same, would scan.
Same, yeah. Same exact product. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, we have been sufficiently warned.
Yes.
Yep. We won't drink the brown stuff, we promise.
No, man. You got to do what you got to do, man.
Huh. Guess we're good to go then. But where does anyone even find this stuff? Surely it's not just out there sitting expired on some store shelf, right? Well, actually, according to Jason Liebig, sometimes that's exactly where it is.
There used to be a deli in Midtown Manhattan where I would find like 10-year-old tins of like, where there was some Lifesavers thing they put in a tin, some weird mints, and I was like, what?
On the one hand, you want to report them, but on the other, it's a great source for old
inventory. Like in my neighborhood here in Queens, I literally found, I think, 14-year-old Shock Tarts.
Whoa.
And the great thing was, it was a period in Shock Tarts, and they probably just, their distributor or their background, they're probably just unloading all this old crap, because that's how New York City is, sort of, you know, it's not like other parts of the country. And what was great was, at the time, they had printed on the package 3 for 99 cents, right? So it was like 2001. And I know, you know, and you go up to a deli, they don't worry about prices. They say, oh, it's $1. I was like, I don't know. They say 3 for 99 cents.
Wow!
And he looks at me, he's like, oh.
Cold, bitch.
Cold.
Then I walked out. I think I bought the whole box, which was probably like 10 rolls or something.
I love that. So do you think that going to like a shady bodega is like a great way to find, like, maybe if you're not so specifically set on one, because we got a tip recently to go to like old Paleta guys to like see if we can find old ice cream. And I just thought that was so interesting that you said to go to a like shitty bodega to go find something, because that seems good to me.
Look, I think, you know, because I love all this stuff, you know, I'm plugged into the sort of other worlds that are similar to mine. I know some guys that collect and document old, you know, Krylon paint cans and all this other stuff, right? They did this great book called Cat Matches Color. They're on Instagram called Cat Matches Color. And reading their book was fascinating, because they talk about, like, starting maybe 20 years ago, they're going all around the country, like, they'll visiting these old hardware stores. They would go into like the back rooms of these hardware stores and find this amazing, you know, new old stock of Krylon colors that they'd never seen before. And they were able to do that. With old food, it's possible.
Right.
You know, like because I've done some TV stuff, and I just had this conversation with some producers last week. I said, look, there's always the conversation that's like, well, how about we do sort of like American Pickers, where you're going around the country searching for this stuff?
Yeah.
And I was like, I love that idea. Except, and this sort of speaks to your larger question, finding leads to get this stuff. I said, look, if you're trying to go out and find old Doritos 3D bags or whatever, right?
It's like a comedy routine at this
that
point.
That is akin to having a show like, oh, we're going to go out and find old food packaging. That's akin to having a show, and this is the example I was using, to finding lost Andy Warhol sketches. Don't get me wrong. They're in books, in people's bookshelves or attics or whatever. The stuff is out there, but you would have 20 episodes of the show and never find a single one.
You would never. Yeah. It's like hunting for cryptids.
So yeah. I think, like, with those Cat Matches Color guys, you have a much better chance of finding old paint at an old hardware store than you do finding an old food product at an old bodega. It's not impossible, though. Like I said, that happened in my own neighborhood. You can definitely find, when I was first really sort of starting like 15 years ago, I checked every place that I would see, right? And I'd find like, oh, 5-year-old Kit Kats, right? Because, oh, that's because right. Sort of like the way collecting baseball cards were when I was a kid, or if it was 4 years old, that felt like a million years old, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Find it. And now, of course, you know, that's the way it is with food. Once it's gone, man, it's gone. You know, like, food is so ephemeral and so fast. That unless someone has specifically collected it, you're just not going to get it. So I found stuff like that, but we're talking like 18 months, 4 years old, maybe not 20 years old. But it does happen. I took a trip through Canada 10 years ago. Again, I was finding like 10, 15-year-old product in this one particular store, not anywhere else, but I found a few things in this one store. I was like, oh, look at this.
It's amazing.
And then there are the amazing stories. in my world, which is, oh, there was a store, there was a general store that closed down. My parents had it. They closed it down 30 years ago and they just left all the product on the shelf.
Oh my
God. There's been a few of those stories that popped up.
Treasures trove.
I talked about Bubble Yum before. Bubble Yum, this stuff is all massively rare, massively esoteric. But if you want an original 1970s Bubble Yum flavor, they are relatively common. Because 15 years ago, there was this guy in Pennsylvania who was driving by this old gas station that had been closed down forever. One day, he sees a guy cleaning it. So he stops in, and he walks in, the guy's cleaning, and he sees these boxes of products. And it was literally a case box of Bubble Yum from 1977.
What are the odds?
So the guy starts throwing this stuff on eBay, like a full display box of Bubble Yum from 1975. It's like, oh, $30. You know, like $5.
Yeah, yeah, just ruining the economy. Yeah. You can just ruin the economy if someone's like, oh, I got this, you know?
Well, and that's it. You know, that the interesting thing is, too, I always say it's an interesting hobby from a collectible standpoint, because the stuff is ridiculously ephemeral. If you encounter something once, typically that's amazing, right? There are cases like with the PB Crisp where there are these sales kits out there, but I've been doing this for 15 years. There's a lot of stuff I've never seen, a lot of stuff I've seen once, and I'm so glad I did what I had to do to get it. But it's also like, look, the Apple cart can be overturned very easily, right? Let's say, oh, I worked on that brand. I've got 5 pounds of the stuff.
It's out there. Yeah. That's crazy.
But most of those things have been thrown away. Companies, I'm a big Wonka candy guy, and the company Nestle that owned the Wonka brand in 2008, they dumped their 50-year sample room. So they had stuff going back to 40 years before they owned the brand. So they had Sweet Tarts packs from 1963. They just dumped it in the trash. So
damn, that's why would they do that?
Museum. Put it in a museum. Just donate it.
Wrigley, which is a complicated story I won't get into too much here, but I helped save the 100-year archive of Wrigley because it was about to be dumped in a series of dumpsters. And it was, and I call it the Smithsonian of American chewing gum, because Wrigley, starting in like 1908, started saving everything they made, examples of everything. Not only that, they were also saving competitor samples. They had like 100 years of every chewing gum product, period, full stop.
Wow.
And the photos I have of it are amazing. And it was this close to getting dumped into Chicago landfill.
Incredible.
Were it not for me.
Incredible.
Thank you.
That is nutty.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Dang. Man's truly a candy culture warrior, isn't he? That's because, according to Jason Liebig, candy isn't just an interesting part of our cultural history. It's the motherfucking forgotten fifth pillar of nerd fandom.
When I started, I just wanted three things. I was not going to become a collector. I wanted a hot tamales box, the style I had when I was a kid.
The old
school, sugar crisp cereal box, the style I had as a kid. And a marathon bar wrapper, which is my favorite discontinued candy bar from the 70s, which was Mars. And to put this into perspective, there was only one image of a marathon bar wrapper. It was 100 pixels. It was about this big. So there was no detail. It was just this grainy little thing. No images of the thing at all. And I started going down the rabbit hole trying to find them. And it took years. It took years to find one hot tamales box. But if you want a Mickey Mantle rookie card or an Amazing Fantasy 15, there's probably 20 of them on eBay right now.
That's so crazy.
Not to say this stuff is more, you know, more valuable, but it's far more ephemeral, far more rare than any collectible hobby I've ever had in my hands.
I never thought about that, but it kind of makes sense.
So many people have a connection. It's wild because it doesn't seem like there's that many, you know, candy collectors, right? It doesn't seem like compared to like how many comic book collectors there are.
Yeah.
Compared to how many people read comic books, right?
I feel like there's never been a speculative market with candy. Like, at some point with a lot of those other hobbies, there's been a point in history where people are like, these will be valuable one day.
Yes.
But I never hear people, when a new cereal comes out, it's never like, you better grab those because one day, you know.
Well, you pull out the Doritos.
I've worked really hard to stop that from happening.
Uh-huh.
Like, I never talk about prices. I never talk about that kind of stuff.
Right.
I did have a guy who was an old school collector. All right, man, you ought to like do a price guide. You ought to talk about something. I don't want anybody else into this. I go, if one of those fucking like baseball card guys comes over here, I'm dead, right? Like, I don't have $20,000 to spend. So that's how, you know, it's also, look, it is very ephemeral. The cost to entry to try to have a really fun candy wrapper collection, if you want old stuff, the barriers to entry are you got to be really, really patient. You got to be willing to spend years to find one thing. And most people, especially people with cash, they don't have that kind of patience. And it's very hard, you know, like I said, if I have 100,000 pieces in my archives, and I don't know that that's the case, but it's probably the case, 40,000 of them are one of a kind. Like, I've never found another example of that specific piece, you know? Yeah. So in the realm of pop culture ephemera, I find this stuff to be fascinating. One of my metaphors that I like to describe, I said, imagine the Beatles' White Album came out in 69 or whatever it did. You know, it was on the radio. People bought it. People owned it. And, you know, or let's bring it back to comics. Amazing Spider-Man issues 1 through 100, right? Let's say they were published. People read them. But now no one had copies, right? Marvel didn't have film of the things. You know, they threw it all out. And so how would we discuss that material? Well, people would remember reading them. They would remember the stories, but they wouldn't be able to ever reference the actual thing, right?
Right.
And that is the history of junk food and the history of candy. Largely, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've documented like 15,000 things online, 20,000 things over the last 15 years. Yes, I've documented a lot. But before that, most of the stuff wasn't even, you couldn't even see it. So how do we just, and most of, like, as much as I've done, I've barely scratched the surface. So there's so much that is just lost to time. I just published, where was it? I just published something. Oh, I just put this on my Instagram today. This thing, Laugh-A-Lots. This company, Van Mels, who make Airheads, they came out with this the same time they came out with Airheads in 1986. And there's no images of this online, at least until today. There was no reference to it online. Wow. So the conversations around this stuff are like talking about myths in a way.
No images at all online.
There's a lot of power that he has, right? Like, if you had like a very convincing fake, you could be like, oh yeah, this candy existed, and just make it up. And I'll bet you there's droves of people that'd be like, I totally remember. Yeah. They were so good.
That's the thing too. You know, there was like early on, one of the things, like I also am obsessed with the Nerds brand, the Nerds candy brand. And people would talk about this hot and cold Nerds. Oh yeah, man, there was a hot and cold Nerds. It had like a hot cinnamon and like a cool peppermint side.
Okay.
I said, man, I don't remember that at all. That sounds really cool. And I saw a lot of people talking about it. And it took me 3 years to track down an image of it. And it was from a candy trade magazine. There was an ad that featured that flavor. And I was like, holy shit, that's real. But what was interesting is everyone online referred to them as Nerds hot and cool, hot and cold. But they're actually hot and cool Nerds, which is a small thing, but it shows you how without an actual reference point, people's memory starts to change.
It's like a murder trial. Yeah, exactly.
The misinformation will, in a sinister way, become the reality.
Like witness testimony, yeah. Nuts.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah.
So, freaking wild. And then a few years after that, I actually found an actual box because I tracked down, this is another thing. I did. I tracked down one of the designers, the graphic designers who worked on the brand. And
what a weird, that's not what you would expect. And it's crazy how much of a connection people have to this stuff. Like, how many Laugh-A-Lots must have been sold?
I think about like the marathon bar, because Laugh-A-Lots was probably out for a year and then gone. But like my thing, the marathon bar, right, was out from 73 to about 82. That's 10 years, roughly.
It's a long fucking time, yeah.
That was 10 years from Mars. That was sold in every mom and pop store in every small town in America. I'm from a small town in Nebraska. There were tons of them there. They must have sold hundreds of millions of them. And try to find a wrapper. You know, good luck. You're not going to find one on eBay. Probably not.
Amazing. Yeah, because it's trash, essentially.
Yeah, it's trash. And so it's fun because it's almost like collecting comic books in 1955, collecting this stuff, you know. I'm not of the mind that it's all going to be worth money. I do think there is some stuff that has the, and already, don't get me wrong, that since I've started publishing a lot of stuff, I've seen prices go up on certain things that are nostalgic, broadly nostalgic. I myself have, in meetings and talking to people, I've said, look, I truly believe junk food and candy is the fifth pillar of geek culture, right? I almost launched a podcast called The Fifth Pillar because if you think about when our love of video games, comics, of toys, movies, of cartoons, it's all developed in this sort of primordial adolescent stew, right?
It has the flavor for sure.
Our love of these brands comes from that same place. It comes from that same location. So when I show something to people, when I take like this, when I show this to Sean Robert, right?
Yeah.
That's what he was talking about. He goes, that's the only picture of a Quackers I've ever seen. I'm actually sending this to him soon. So.
He was literally talking about that on our show.
So he like told me, I was like, you really love that one, huh? So I'm like, I'm digging through my stuff. I know I've got the Quackers box somewhere. But you know, that's the only one. That's the only one anybody knows exists. That's if you come from comics or any of this other stuff, it's like, how is that possible? But it is. And yes, there are others out there. Inevitably there are. But until someone starts, I don't know, until some asshole starts like putting these things in hard plastic cases with a thing on the top.
Wait for it.
Say, what's the population report, sir? It's like, oh, it's only one.
$10 million.
Well,
no, I mean, what they did with video games is
bonkers. The $1 million Mario 64 is wild to me when I have one in my house. You know what I mean?
It's so ridiculous.
Well, you know what they say? One man's trash is another man's slightly more collectible trash. But speaking of, this next section is about some of Jason's wildest finds.
People do ask me where I find things. I say, listen, all I've been doing for the past 15 years is shaking trees, you know?
Right.
Like I said, you've heard some of the stories. One of the greatest finds of candy wrappers I ever found was from a book published in 1983. And I'll tell you, this is my last story, I promise. Yeah. 1983, it was 2011 when I got this book. So the book at that point was almost 30 years old. And it was a book about the history of candy bars and candy, you know, chocolate wrappers and all that stuff. And there was a little box with a picture of a chocolate bar, Mars Forever Yours bar from 79, which at that point was fairly recent. But the image had a credit for this guy. His name was Leonard Kallick. And so I was like, oh, man, I wonder if this Leonard Kallick guy is still around. I wonder if he's a chocolate bar wrapper collector, right? Because finding collectors is almost impossible. I've probably found most of them because I was really looking. And so I start about a 3-week search. I'm Googling, you know, there's no Leonard Kallick on Facebook. There's no, you know, this. But I find a California real estate website, right, that mentions the name. And I was like, oh, fuck, man, this is a pretty unusual name. So I had one of my outreaches, there was like little apps on your iPhone where you can send out postcards, right, without having to go to the post office. I was like, it's great. I can do this all from my, I had like a thing, a design that I slapped on the back. You type in the text. I sent it to the address that was on this California website. About 3 weeks later, I get an email from the guy. It's my email address is on. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, that was me. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I collected wrappers for a long time. I haven't really looked at them in about 10 years, but I still have them. And we started talking. And about 6 months later, he sold me his collection. He gave me a price, and I doubled it. And I told him, I said, this stuff is worth way more. So he gave me a price. I literally doubled it. And we're still friends, you know, I see him when I'm out there, but I almost didn't know what was in it. Right. Cause he said, well, you know, he didn't send me pictures of everything. He sent me like 7 or 8 pictures. Right. He said, well, there's about 600 brands represented. I'm like, what does that mean? 600 brands represented. I don't quite know. So when I get the box, it was about 22 pounds of paper. It was in two boxes. And I started going through it and, you know, the true story, like half of it I've just never seen before, you know? So it's like, it is like opening up a time machine, you know? And so you're like, I didn't even know this thing existed, or things I've been looking for years. You know, I open it up and see. And so that became one of the foundations of the archive that I've built out over the last 15 years to do all this stuff. But it shows you the crazy lengths by which you have to go to find some of the stuff. And of course, collecting candy up there, having published 600 articles, whatever the 600 are,
right.
I do occasionally get people to email me, and that's the best, you know. Hey,
that's how you happens on its own. Yeah, I got this rare thing. Yeah.
Yeah, people found like there was a thing I was looking for a friend of mine. I would love to have one myself. My friend had wanted one for 30 years. He was looking for the Sour Bites thing. And so I did an article on Sour Bites, took the images from the television commercial that were out there, you know, that you could find. And I said, if anyone ever finds one, email me. And this guy found this Sour Bites pack. They were basically a Beech Nuts knockoff of Sweet Tarts, but really fun packaging. And he found it in an old game board box, right?
A little
game
box.
Someone, you know, like the little plastic Tiddlywink things, the flat plastic disc, right? Someone had used the opened pouch to store the game pieces. That's how it was saved.
And that's the only way you're going to find certain things
romantic.
Like that, man.
That's so romantic.
Somebody using fucking, I don't know, somebody using like a classic baseball card as a bookmark. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Endless. No, I mean, there's a Twinkies box I own that someone kept their stamp collection. That's why it was saved. You know, it was the Devil's Food Twinkies, which I always say it's the Black Sheriff, because they literally had Twinkie the Kid in his cowboy getup, but he was brown. So I call it my Blazing Saddles Twinkie box, right? That's a lot of shit.
Where all the white cream at?
Still one of my favorite things. But it's, but the stuff, that's the thing. It's, you'll occasionally find like a collector or a scrapbook or something, but it's like, then the crazier story is where it's like, oh, it was behind a locker in a battleship. You know, we were redoing a battleship and we pulled this locker down. You know, the locker bank down.
Everybody eats candy, right?
And there was stuff tucked behind. So there was that I got again. And it's almost the crazy things for all the stuff that I had. Anytime there's a find, it's always a ton of stuff I've never seen. That shows you how big the world is.
Yeah. But there's not even like the, what's most fascinating isn't the like unknown, where are these things? It's the unknown unknown of like, what do I know about?
You have no checklist. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there is no, that's right. There's no checklist. Yes. That's it. That's why I think that's one of the barriers to keeping it from ever becoming the thing that the guys who spend $100,000 on an unopened Nintendo cartridge are ever going to get into, because for them, this guy, Darren Ravel, who used to be on ESPN as a pal of mine, he slid into my DMs a couple of years ago when he was trying to find these alternative collectible hobbies. But what about candy? And I was like, listen, man, you know, because he was talking about cereal, like I talked to him about cereal box. He goes, I wish people graded these. Because for him, and I look, he was on ESPN, he's successful, he's doing well, he's got an incredible collection of things, but they're all graded, right? His understanding of this thing is population reports, right? It has to be from a company having a population report and all these other things. And I'm super cynical about that stuff, right? I dismiss it.
Yeah, you're the guy who pulled strawberry duds out of the damn wall. You know, yes. Who knows?
And it doesn't matter what condition that strawberry duds in, right? Who fucking cares? Find another one.
You proved the existence of a new life form. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's one of my side hustles, which maybe you know this, is I do consulting for period television shows. So like I work with them and I send them a high resolution scan of a piece to create something for a prop. And then I invoice for it. Right. So I've worked on Mad Men, Stranger Things, that Ego box and Stranger Things. That's made from mine. You know, I've got the, because, right. Because when they started looking for a 1980s Ego box, I had the only one. That was the only image of one online. And that's because when I started, I was like, I want a 1980s Ego box. I'm going to start looking for it. Oh, and okay. God damn it. One more story. One of the ways we used to be able to find things is refunders. Refunders for people who collect packaging like I do in the 90s and early 2000s, refunders was a potential great source to find stuff. Refunders were typically old school. Most housewives were women, or most people at home. Women who started in the 60s started saving packaging to send away for offers, right? Before proof of purchase seals, before box tops, and all this. But they would tend to save the full package because the producers, the manufacturers didn't want women saving box tops for 10 years and then sending all their box tops in to get something. So they would change what would be like this part of the label or this. So these refunders started having their little newsletters and their zines and stuff they would mail out to each other. They would have file cabinets full packages of things. Empty, but full packages.
Wild scene, yeah.
So guys like Dan Goodsell, author of Crazy Kids Food, they started to track down some of these refunders who were still on, because when the internet came, refunding in the old school way went away. But I found that AgoBox, because this woman, there was an old website called Serial Bitch, which was a serial collector's website. This woman, beautiful, lovely old lady, had a file cabinet she was getting rid of all this old packaging. That's actually how I got my first PB Crisp, was from her. It was an empty pack.
Amazing.
And she had saved all this packaging, file cabinets and little things, to eventually send in for an offer when Planters or Kellogg's or whoever would say, hey, if you send in box tops from Ego, you'll be able to get this, I don't know, glassware set.
Right.
But at that point, she knew that was all done. She was saying, and the funny thing was, when she came to us, she was like, unfortunately, all my cereal boxes, my son-in-law hauled them all out to recycling like a couple months ago. And I remember all the monster cereals. So she probably threw away like tens of thousands of dollars of value in cereal boxes. But so that was one of my first entries to one of those finds. And still to this day, about the only refunder find I've ever been, because even by 2010, refunders pretty much gone the way
people figured it out. Yeah.
But it was a legitimate way. Circling back to everything, that this stuff that was fully disposable in our disposable culture was purposefully saved. It was refunders. And but they, again, you know, it's just if you find a refunder stash, it's pretty exciting.
Man, doesn't a refunder stash sound like something from a Bethesda game? I bet if I found one, there'd be like a dope gauntlet in there or something that would blow my mind. I don't know. And anyway, speaking of, here's Jason sharing some of what he finds most exciting about the work and what he thinks is important to treasure about the sacred and surprisingly deep world of candy collecting.
I'll say if you got time for one more story.
We're here. Please.
All right. I've been completely obsessed. The Milk Duds people, a company called Holloway's, did fruit-flavored Milk Duds in the 70s.
Ooh.
Oh.
Sound terrible. They were more like a fruit chew in the dud shape. You know,
for sure.
They're probably caramel-based. I only knew of grape duds when I started, and eventually I would track down the other flavors. Last year, I finally found what I think is the last flavor that was created, banana, but I've been looking for that for 10 years. But one of the first ones I found was one I didn't even know existed, because there was literally nothing, anything I'd ever seen. Someone was redoing their bathroom and they're pulling down the wall, and inside the wall, as people do, there was a strawberry duds box just stuck in there.
What kind of Andy Dufresne shit is this?
With the wax. Yeah. And I was also obsessed. And so but I got that like 11 years ago. I've never seen another one. I've never found in all this doc. I have all this trade documentation. I've never seen strawberry duds mentioned in any of it. But grape, cherry, and banana were the three duds flavors they originally released. I suspect it's possible there's another one out there, because if were it not for that guy breaking down that piece of wall, I still, even with all the research, I still would not know that there was a strawberry duds box.
That's like from another universe.
Yeah.
It is like from another universe. That's it, right? Yeah. There was like a great, I was so happy this guy, I was obsessed with this snack that I grew up with, Nabisco Doodads. It was like a snack mix, like Chex Mix. And I loved it more than Chex Mix. Doodads is what it's called. And this guy was like up in like an Ace Hardware store, but it had been some other store before, but he was up in the rafters and finds like a box of Doodads from like 74 in the original, whatever the original. So some workman just sat down in the insulation, sat there for 40 years, man. And I convinced him to sell it to me. I paid him probably more than it would have sold for on eBay. You know, I was like, I don't care.
Wow.
You know,
that's have crazy.
It's the, you know, that's the crazy thing. It's the only one. It's like the only one you find. And it's, you know, it's a dangerous, you can become a dangerous person when you get into the realization, oh, you got to get it. You know, and then it's just like,
it's Indiana Jones.
Money,
yeah. It's
all
Indiana
your money Jones goes dead into ass. Stuff,
you know? Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Nothing like that in comics. You know what I mean? There's nothing like that. A comic book. Oh, Spider-Man, another issue of Spider-Man that nobody know of. Nobody, right. That doesn't happen.
Yes.
Because even though comic books are like,
that's
they were originally thought of as disposable, they weren't thought of as consumable.
Yeah.
Like food is meant to be like, num, num, num. This is literally trash.
Yeah.
It's not like comic covers were trash that you have to like
throw away.
You have to like open up to read the good stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's not like when you read it, it's like gone.
Yeah.
You don't read by eating. Yeah. Yeah.
The ephemeral nature of things, the things we collect. I mean, again, you guys could talk about this forever. I could talk about this forever too. There was a point at which like a guy had all these, the newspaper comic sections from newspapers, right? He was saving.
Yeah. Okay.
He was selling like the full sections. I was into them at that point because they had ads for candy things I'd never seen before, right? Illustrated. But I was thinking about, and the first question when I started seeing them all, because he had a ton. And I was like, who saves the comic sections of newspapers, right? Like what kind of crazy person? I was like, but wait a second. What makes a comic book
right
any different? And this, yeah, they're the same fucking thing.
No, you know? Yeah. I used to collect them. I used to collect the funny pages when I was
no kidding. Look at this.
I did.
They are the same. They are literally the same thing. And I was like, well, that's why, you know. But you know, the ephemeral nature of it is wild. And one of the fun things for me, because I told somebody, you know, if there was an encyclopedia, a visual encyclopedia of junk food when I started, that I could have went out and paid $50 for, I probably in 2002 or whenever it was, I probably would have bought that book, put it on my bookshelf, and who knows what I'd be doing with my life right now. You know? But it wouldn't have been this. But the fact that none of it was out there, the fact that I had to chase them, you know, and then it became this really fun thing where the more I got into it, the more I got into it, right? The more passionate I became about it. Things I didn't care about. There's things I've gotten like in groups of things that I got 10 years ago that, oh, what's that? Nothing. I throw it in the box. And then I go back through my stuff and I was like, oh my God, I got this. But I didn't realize how cool this was when I first got it 10 years ago. And I was like, oh, now I realize how cool. But so, but the stuff you just, I'm still, even after 15 years, I'm still making new discoveries like every few months. You know, it's like, I didn't know that existed. I didn't know there was a cool Gobstoppers in the 70s, like a minty cool Gobstopper. How have I never seen
it? I didn't know that either. Yeah.
So it's a world that's, there's so much discovery. Like you said, who's finding another issue of John Romita Spider-Man? Nobody.
Nobody. Right? Yeah.
Like the comparisons thing in comics,
that you're making.
Closest thing in comics would be when someone, again, it wasn't like a secret, but someone said, you know, in South America, they didn't want to kill Gwen Stacy, so they started making a whole series.
That's real shit. Right? Yeah. That's real shit. I heard about
like,
this.
Yeah, no, like, that's the closest thing. Like that's kind
of like some ash can.
There is a story about that I know that is this guy has some stuff that I don't know. I have to figure out what I can actually say about. Needless to say, you know, Count Chocula and Booberry and Frankenberry, right? We know these guys, right? They celebrated their 50th anniversary last year. General Mills explored a whole lot of other monsters before they chose those three. And no one's ever written about it. So no one's ever seen them.
That's a TV. Bit of information.
It's a huge story. And
we know about the others.
He doesn't want, he's not willing to share
Fruit Brute and them.
So, although somebody showed the stuff to leak this up just a couple weeks ago. And I was like, dude, you got to take that down. He does not want that stuff out there. Anyway, and he did. But I'm sure they're going to be popping up now because this guy leaked them. I've been holding on to them for years. For the 50th anniversary, man, we can make this a national news story. It would be so much fun. It's just like, and the guy's like, because it was connected to his father who passed away. And it was like, I respected like all that.
Whatever. Yeah.
You gotta, you know, it's his story to tell, as we say.
Sure.
But all the stuff you said, you guys definitely understand it. You know, it is like getting something from a parallel universe. I will occasionally remark that. I'll see something. And it's, for all that I've managed to document, it's probably, I used to say a lot, I used to say it's like the fossil record. If I found 100,000 things, there's probably a million more that I haven't. And that
The holy calling. Yeah.
It's bonkers. But then about 2% of it is broadly nostalgic for a ton of people, you know? So it's like, oh yeah, Alexander the Great, man, that's thing. Or it's like, oh yeah, that's my Lemonheads box from when I was a kid. That kind of stuff people get. PB Crisp, very nostalgic. Doritos 3D, super nostalgic. You know, Rascals, occasionally nostalgic for people.
I remember Rascals, yeah.
You know, Quackers, you know, not nostalgic for a ton of people, but for Sean Robert, very nostalgic.
Blew his mind, blew his fucking mind. You know, I don't think I'll ever figure it out. What is it about stuff from when we were kids feeling so much better? Why must these complicated feelings torment us so? Why do things always have to change? Well, to close us out, according to Jason, that's kind of just the way it is, man.
That's the thing, too. Even if things like PB Crisp come back, I know Planters just recently brought back their cheese balls.
And
most people were of the mind that, oh, these are not like anything like I remember having when I was a kid. They used to be completely, I was addicted to them, and these things are trash or whatever.
Right.
And there's a million reasons for that. If you start to dive into processed food or food products in general, factory produced food products, it's almost impossible to make something the way that it used to be made. But like when they brought back Oreo's cereal, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that was a segment on my cooking channel show we did all about products that went away and came back. And I got to meet with the people who developed it. I got to meet with the flavor scientists and the tasters and everything, which was really fun. But you know, they knew people wanted it back, but they also had decided, or they knew through their studies, there's people with MBAs, I guess, who are focus grouping people, that the flavor tastes of 2017 were not the flavor tastes of 1995. Uh-huh. And so they tweaked it. And I'll be honest, I remember, you know, getting up with a hangover at Friend's Place in San Diego and like having a bowl of Oreos. And I was like, oh, this kind of sucks. But when I got the new Oreos, now maybe look, maybe it's because I was working on a show, I was at the factory, but these fucking things were delicious.
They Oreo brought out the real cereal ones for you.
Like, yeah. I found the new Oreo cereal to be great. Like, so I was of the mind that they really did a great job. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's tough. This is crazy. One of the esoteric reasons why some things are discontinued is because a piece of machinery breaks.
And nothing can replicate, basically, right?
What kind of McDonald's-ass logic is that? Fuck.
I mean, it's the only one that exists, right?
There was a candy company there's still a candy company called Ghirardelli, and they made a thing called Flix, which are these little chocolate drops, very West Coast. You guys are West Coast. And the machine famously busted, but it had been making Flix since like 1910. And they were like, nobody knows how to fix it, and they don't sell very much anyway, so let's just stop making
it. It's like a Star Trek episode. Like a society that has like one water machine and it breaks. And so like we are done for.
Well, there was, I'll never, cause I knew about the Flix story and then something happened. There was a fire in one of the switching stations in the New York City subway on the west side of Manhattan. And they said it would take 3 years before train service would return to where it was because that switching station was built like in 1920 and no one fully understood the signals that went in and came out and how it all was supposed to work.
It's just something that's been working.
They had to rebuild it from the ground up, which is crazy. I know Brock's made a thing called Maple Nut Goodies, which are really tasty. And the Brock's company went through bankruptcy, was saved by a company called Fairly and Sathers. Then they were merged with a company called Ferrero Candy Company. Then Ferrero Candy merged with this other company. Anyway, but I remember hearing about the Maple Nut Goodies. Maple Nut Goodies from like the 20s were made on these old wood trays at this factory. But when they had to close down that factory and move them, they couldn't grandfather all that equipment. So they had to start making them on modern equipment.
Right.
And the modern equipment, they couldn't figure out a way to continue they were coming out way too hard. So people were breaking their teeth on them. Like this was like just 5 or 6 years ago. And because like an old, I don't know, some old oak drying board or whatever allowed more moisture to be in there, or however the factory was built. I've talked, you know, so there's all this weird esoteric stuff. You'd think it's just a science, like, oh, they plug in a certain thing into a computer and out comes a product. But it's not. It's and don't get me wrong, they have modern factories, all these crazy controls, humidity and everything else. Everything's down to the milliliter or whatever. Right.
They know it all, yeah.
It has to be for them to have that repetitive ability. So processed food is such high science stuff. It's just wild. And so old stuff sometimes goes away because there's like, we don't even know. I think Mars, like my favorite, the Marathon bar, there've been people who've been like, oh, they should bring it back. And I'm certainly one of those people. But I was friends with the candy buyer for Walgreens, huge buying power, right? Second, maybe to only like Target or Walmart or Dollar Tree at this point. They wanted to do a special throwback for the summer. Like summer 2016 or something, they went to Mars and said, listen, we want to bring back the Marathon bar, Walgreens exclusive. We're going to fill our stores with them for like 6 months. Can we do it? Mars is like, no.
Wow.
And I think it's not worth the
money. Is that what's up?
Yeah. I think it was none of their equipment could be easily repurposed into that room.
Right.
You know, that's my assumption. I don't know.
It's like some foods are discontinued before you even like, you might still be eating it and you're not eating the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, and that's the thing too, like Butterfinger, because Nestle sold their US confectionery brands. The Italian company Ferrero,
Ferrero,
that's right. They purchased all of those brands, but they had 2 years later, earlier, they had purchased Ferrera candy, a separate family, separate company.
So far.
Oh, I didn't know.
A little confusing because there's only like two letters difference.
Yeah.
But now Ferrero has completely bought their way into the US confectionery business because they bought Ferrera, who had recently merged with Fairly and Sathers, so that the Brock's lines, the Heidi lines and all these. But then they spent $1.2 billion to buy all of the U.S. Nestle confectionery business, which is Wonka, Sweet Tarts, Butterfinger, Baby Ruth. So when you say things change, one of the things they did with Butterfinger, they thought it wasn't doing well enough. They did some focus groups. They changed the recipe and they put right on the wrapper, which was their mistake.
New recipe.
And I truly believe, because I have a lot of people complain to me, oh, no, the new Butterfinger's trash. I was like, I think if they wouldn't have put that on the wrapper, those people would have no clue. And maybe
no idea. Yeah.
I might be a little arrogant saying that, but recipes change all the time.
Right.
And very few things, recipes like Coca-Cola, yes, they're recipes, but candy changes all the time. Like even from Hershey and stuff, they'll change, they'll tweak things. They're not telling you all the time. Like in the 70s, because of the cost of sugar, because of inflation, they were changing from milk chocolate to less milk chocolate. You know, lots of things change all the time. Yeah. Wow. You can tell, I look at my wrappers because it's like, it'll go from milk chocolate to just chocolate. You know, they'll change the wording. You can look at the ingredients, you look at the sizes. So many things were changing back then all the time.
Do you think that New Coke was a false flag operation to launch high fructose corn syrup Coke?
Is that too controversial? I believe that was a legit fuck up. I believe they legit thought, because the Pepsi challenge was nipping on their heels. Pepsi's a sweeter taste. You know, there's been like, what is it? The guy, was that guy that wrote The Tipping Point and all those books?
Gladwell. Yeah.
Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell talks about the Pepsi challenge. Now, so from in a sip test, Pepsi tastes delicious. It's really sweet. But when you're drinking it all, it's a little too much, right? It's like all the special flavors. Like I just had maple Pepsi. It's like, oh, that's interesting. But like, ooh, you know,
you don't want to slam a whole bottle of it, though.
Brutal. Yeah. It's like all these weird flavors of Mountain Dew, and I love what Mountain Dew is doing from a branding perspective. It's incredible. Or Oreo. There's a reason why Kool-Aid flavored Oreos aren't out all the time, but they're good like once every 5 years.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so it's like, so I truly believe New Coke was a legit mistake. You know, because there's one thing I've learned working at Marvel Comics is executives make mistakes. just circle back. No, yeah. It's like, look, people make mistakes, and big corporate guys with MBAs who've worked their way up to these companies or jump from company to company, they make mistakes too. They see what they think is writing on the wall, and it's not.
They're forgetting about nostalgia, emotions, hearts. Yeah.
You look at them, look at the movie business. What happened as soon as Marvel started creating their franchise, right? Everyone's like, oh, we're going to do the Transformers, you know, cinematic universe. We're going to do the Ghostbusters cinematic universe. We're going to do the Star Wars. We're going to do all these things. It's like, I don't think it really paid. Like, what is Star Wars recently saying again? I don't want to segue up. But with the Han Solo movie, I guess we're never going to recast those characters again. And my thing is, I don't think you're paying attention to the right. Sometimes you're not paying attention to the right lesson. After Deadpool came out, it's like, oh, we got to do rated R superhero films. It's like, that's not the fucking lesson, man. You know?
Yeah.
But that's
an accurate movie.
It's understandable how they would not learn lessons when these people don't leave their gilded offices. You know what I mean?
Look, everybody has a perspective, and you know, everybody loves what they love for the reasons they love it. And you know, if anything, the last few Star Wars movies have taught me that, right? You know, it's like some people love the people who love the second of the latest trilogy, right? Hated the third. The people who love the third hated the second. And yeah, some of that is easy to identify, right? Some of it's just bad people. Or they have bad ideas of the world or how the world should be. But some of it's just taste. And you know, people's tastes are informed by so many things, but so are executives. And at a certain point, they're just, I understand why they don't take chances or why they're trying to hedge all their fucking bets, because they want a job, because it's a cold business, right? They're like, you didn't make $1 billion. You're out.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to think about it in terms of candy flavors, right?
Oh, look, I always talk about this. I mean, look at all the products under the Airheads brand. Look at all the products under Reese's. You know, when there's a new Reese's thing comes out, it seems like every year, right?
Right.
40 years ago, that would have not had the Reese's name on it. It would have been something else.
Right.
Hershey's Take Five, which I think was one of their great bars, got pretzel in it, caramel, butter.
Yeah, great bar.
They rebranded it a lot, like 7 years ago. It almost looked like a protein bar when they rebranded it. That didn't really work. So then they recently rebranded under the Reese's umbrella. And I was like, whatever you have to do, and there is Reese's peanut butter in there. But it was like, yes, keep it alive because it's a great bar. And if that helps get to people. But yeah, 40 years ago, there would have been 40 products. Now there's just 40 Reese's products. You know, there would have been all
the MCU things. Candy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to make people feel invested, like emotionally invested in this brand.
Yeah.
Branding, you know, these powerful brands, they need to, I mean, look at Oreo, you know, there's Nabisco used to make a whole lot of other cookies. even double stuff, when double stuff was introduced, the name Oreo in the very first year was not on the package. They were just double stuff cookies.
That's really interesting.
And then they became Oreo double stuff like a year or two later. And that's the thing people forget. But then they made other sandwich cookies, you know, that ultimately nowadays they would just be an Oreo sub brand.
Type of Oreo. Yeah.
You know, and I like it. I like it both ways. Like I like new products, but I love when brands just do like a million variations.
Anthropologically, it's as interesting, right? There's nothing particularly more interesting about one way people do things than another way. It's just, you know, as people who would think about it, we kind of have trouble stepping outside of our own
comfort zone
experience a little bit. And so sometimes we get mad about a Star Wars movie or Coca-Cola in a way that maybe we shouldn't be because we're thinking about things differently. Yeah, I don't know.
It's okay to be passionate, but like, let's take it down.
A chill pill.
Passion and consideration are not mutually exclusive.
You know, yes, right? No. And I like one of my favorite terms is thoughtfully consider, man. Thoughtfulness, thoughtfulness. Yeah.
100%.
Sometimes it's hard, but thoughtfulness is good.
And with those wise words, we're going to call it a day. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with a regular S episode for you guys soon, as well as one or two more of these nice interview specials featuring our other expert panelist guests. Thanks again to Jason Liebig for talking to us. Check him out at Collecting Candy on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. And finally, for our Patreon listeners, we didn't forget you. There is a special little something-something over at patreon.com/superbeardbros, where the podcast plus tier has three more short conversations with Jason. One about that time he was an editor at Marvel Comics and didn't want Wolverine to have a backstory, one about the Bigfoot pizza from Pizza Hut, and one about the shelf life of Twinkies. Have a good rest of your day. See you there, or see you soon.